Welcome to the Planet Art Podcast. You've made the right choice today. You've clicked on the right link because we've got some fascinating things to cover. We've got our resident art specialist, Lloyd Roderick. Do you want to say hello today?
Hello.
Do you want to say hello a little bit more enthusiastically?
Hello.
Splendid, thank you. But what you've come to talk about actually is our special guest, Ruben Knudsen. Thank you very much for coming in.
You're welcome. It's good to be here.
You've been waiting for a while because we've been having some, I will call them technical problems, but we've come to talk about your exhibition. Do you want to give us a brief description of what you're doing at the moment?
Brief description, I'll be setting up this exhibition next week down at the School of Arts, Aberystwyth University, and their lovely gallery. They've got a number of gallery spaces there, so I'm in one of their larger spaces, and so I'll be setting up all this stuff next week. Which is a mixture of film projections. I've got a lot of overhead projectors and images and texts, and it's based on, it's the culmination of my PhD work, which is now is in its third and final year.
It's called The Preseli Hills Transcended.
Indeed.
And it's appearing, or it's opening on the 11th of August.
It is.
It's at the department, isn't it, in the art building in
Aberystwyth. In the School of Arts, yeah.
Yeah, so anybody who's interested, that's when it's open, 11th of August. It's looking like a fascinating piece of work. I mean, what makes it fascinating from my point of view? What do you think it is that's going to make people respond to it?
I think because it's about a history which took place in Wales, which is particularly fascinating. Part of Welsh culture, I think, which is to do with the 1970s and the sort of countercultural practices that took place in the 1970s, due in large part to a lot of incomers then, the kind of from England, from the home counties, but not exclusively, but from across England, as part of that whole back to the land ideology, and coming into Wales. Obviously, property was cheap. It's a fascinating historical time because it was full of sort of utopian idealism, but at the same time there's a lot of political and social tension, obviously cultural tension, social tension because of the cheap property and so on, a lot of out-migration, but also you had, it was a time when you had, for a rural place like Wales, where agriculture is key, and that had to respond in dramatic ways to the EU directives. So agriculture was going through a massive sort of productivisation change, and which meant a lot of out-migration of locals, local farmers and so on.
Before we get into some of the big issues and topics you've brought up there, Ruben, should we just go back a little bit and think... The subtitle that I've mentioned, The Preseli Hills Transcended, is the title of the exhibition, and then you've got a subtitle here, Utopian Images of the Past, Present and Future in a 1970s Landscape. So what I was thinking, really, what is the stuff of the exhibition? How is this story told? What are the objects? What is on display? Who's made them? And it's focusing on North Pembrokeshire as well. I suppose the main question is North Pembrokeshire utopia?
Well, no, obviously not. is the short answer. it's a movement that took place across West Wales, across Wales, and across the UK, much of Europe, and California is obviously the most famous example of this sort of back to the land practice that took place in the 60s and 70s. In terms of the exhibition itself, what you'll see are films and photographs from the time, mixed with stuff that I've done, photographs and films that I've made, that have kind of copied. I mean, I'm very interested in as contemporary art practice and in terms of sort of popular culture. I'm interested in historical reenactment and the way people copy history in order to, it's weird. There's a weird sort of will to sort of unfreeze what happened in history, and to look back into historical eras as kind of containing some kind of golden age that we need to return to. But I'm not. I'm kind of being more critical because I don't believe in being quite so nostalgic about the past. But so to be critical as well as trying to identify these utopian moments.
I think this idea of reenactment is quite interesting as well, and I suppose parallel with in this sort of time period. And one of the things I wanted to ask you, and you touched on it a little bit earlier on, was the idea of migration into these areas here. I'm just thinking, this notion of back to the land, this utopian ideal going at this period, to what extent then is this mixed or go parallel with or diverge from or clash against Welsh language movements development at a similar time? And especially thinking in terms of reenactment, because maybe, Dav, you can help me with my memory here. Was it last year or the year before last, the reenactment of the protest on the bridge in Trevechan?
That's right.
In Aberystwyth, yeah. With regard to the language movement there. So does that tie in at all?
I think so, because there's always... I mean, this is the thing with reenactment, and it goes, and that relates as well to, famously, the artist Jeremy Deller staged a reenactment of the Battle of Orgreave, the miners' strikes that took place in 1984. So only, 17 years later, in 2001, he reenacted that massive battle between the police including mounted police and the picketing miners. And it was about trying to grasp this moment, and that was about the loss of the unions, and representing this decline of or fragmentation of community. So there's always a will to reenact these kind of political moments and to kind of reinvigorate a sense of political activism, I think. And I'm interested in that, but I'm also interested in the sort of day-to-day habits and gestures and movements that take place as well. And it's really interesting looking back at films of the time, because obviously, you know, it's surrounded with the sort of stereotypical idea of hippies dancing in the fields and things. But at the same time, when you look at the way people talk, the way they gesture, the way they move, the cars that they drive, all of these sort of hidden ideals that are in there, I think it's quite fascinating. So I think it comes together with this idea. And I think that's what's interesting about the time as well, is you obviously had... a lot of protest and activism in Wales itself for the Welsh language and so on. And I think, and Ned Thomas points this out in his, what I think is a really fantastic book, The Welsh Extremist. And he kind of aligns, he kind of connects the two movements, between the English New Left and Welsh activism. Because really, it's a kind of anti-commodification, anti-capitalism. That's generally what people share. Mm-hmm.
So what are your touchstones here then? By that I mean, what is it that personally brings you into all of these aspects?
I mean, from a very, very personal, on a personal level, my partner grew up in North Pembrokeshire. Her parents were part of that generation. And since meeting her, I've always been fascinated with what went on and what happened. And I think, and sort of knowing about... particularly, as I mentioned, with the sort of California idea and that whole sort of back to the land, rose-tinted view of that whole era, I was just very fascinated to see how that kind of panned out in Wales, in a very, very unique and special place. So in that level, it was just wanting to find out more about it. But also, it felt to me like it was incredibly resonant with the problems we face today, which are to do with a kind of over-commodified world, where we see increasingly, we lose our sense of identity and uniqueness in the face of this homogenized, commodified culture, and the ecological nightmare that we're now kind of living through, which, in the 70s, that was the time when the green movement started, that kind of ecological awareness, this idea of spaceship Earth, traveling through space with finite resources. Suddenly everyone was quite aware that the Earth had only had so much that it could give, and we needed to care for it. So all of those ideas resonate quite strongly with today, I think.
I think that's a, an interesting idea as well, that resonance with today, because just a, so I suppose, a hypothetical question, but would this kind of movement be possible today? As in, would you be able to almost go somewhere, find that place? Are things too connected, too linked up? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, this is the kind of impossible question. Is it? And that's something I kind of touch on. It is to do with how much is it to do with a place, as well. How much can we kind of reenact a place? And I think, and for me, that's why the Preseli's form this fascinating backdrop, because obviously for us over our time they're unchanging, but then as soon as you start going back into deep time, and that's something that I quite like about. The sort of plundering history, if you like, if you can kind of go back to archaic and to prehistory, and start to think about these hills, you know, they represent the Celts, and there was that movement to sort of post Second World War, when they wanted to turn the whole of the Preseli's into a practice range for the MOD.
There still is a lot of Pembrokeshire, still is.
Yeah, there's a lot of different, but they managed to protect it, didn't they? It kind of brought out a lot of that sort of Celtic spirit, you know, the poetry. But, you know, there was, and you might be critical of that, but in terms of this kind of feeling for what the Preseli's stood for and represented their identity, I think that was quite important.
Even though, obviously, it's very much a part of Wales, it still represents border country, doesn't it, Preseli?
True, yeah, that's a good point.
Is there an aspect of, you know, crossing over of that nature coming into as well, culture within culture, also beating against quite an other culture as well.
I mean, it's interesting talking because it started basically. I conduct a lot of oral history interviews with lots of people who came in the '70s, mostly from sort of England, but some as well from sort of Tenby and South Wales, and but who came into North Pembrokeshire, and sort of look back on it now as, you know, they created their bubble, they imported their own life support systems, and it's taken a generation or even two generations for this sort of integration, which they now applaud to take place, you know. But there were kind of parallel universes, if you like.
How problematic was that at the time? Was there a perception of us and them?
Yeah, well, I think, again, it's, you know, there are so many unique stories. For some people, it was a very separate existence they led. And then for a lot of people, they came up because of John Seymour, you know, who was broadcasting and practicing his own sort of self-sufficiency. In North Pembrokeshire at the time, and he was an extremely gregarious, you know, community oriented sort of guy, like him or loathe him, as a lot of people did, but nonetheless he kind of galvanized the local community, and so through him, and so anybody that was either involved directly with him or kind of trying to do some kind of small holding lifestyle would automatically find themselves in the local community, so they have very different stories to tell. And generationally as well, because the older generation of farmers kind of connected with these youngsters coming in and wanting to practice the traditional farming methods, whereas the younger farmers were obviously embracing the EU subsidies with the massive combine harvesters, the fleet of Land Rovers and so on. So each had their own different ideals, and it seemed to work across generations and across types of people in very different ways.
We can hear some silence possibly in the distance. I don't think it's anything to do with us, but apologies for that if you're listening and are concerned about our welfare. How do you represent such broad ideas? And I know we talked about the idea of reenactment. That's one specific thing, isn't it? But how do you represent the broader ideologies of this exhibition visually? Is it a matter of this is what I want to present, I hope it's going to achieve this goal, or are there cracks, are there little holes that people can fall into in between what you're attempting?
There are, yeah. I mean I present a film or a series of films that I've made that sort of reenact moments of people dancing in a field, of the way people talk, and even a car being turned over, which is quite an interesting story that came out. But as well, I have... Yeah, I'll talk more about that in a minute.
Yeah, I was just going to say, making a note, car, yes, on its head.
On its head, yes. But I have a lot of material. It's on. I've got overhead projectors, and so I have a lot of photographs and texts which people have written, quotes, lots of stuff that people have said, and all on acetates, and they can basically all be collaged together. So you can put quotes and texts with images, and so obviously it's a finite amount of stuff, but the configurations sort of vary. So that's where the kind of fragmentation.
Up to the exhibition audience, the exhibition goers, then to do that.
People can go in and they can fiddle around with all the images and make all sorts of connections that they like.
I think it's. I personally, I know it sounds like a child or something, but when I get to touch stuff, what I mean? It makes me feel a lot more involved somehow, and then, I don't know.
And aside from Dav touching stuff, who were these people then? These oral histories you've collected, these things you've reenacted. Who were the people you went to for that? Who contributed to this in that way?
Hold on to that. Are you holding on to those files? Are they going to be available for people to listen to before going to the exhibition or anything like that?
The oral history files. There's a website.
Yeah.
Actually, on which there are quite a lot of kind of I've edited out clips from the oral history interviews, and obviously post PhD I'll create something.
Do you remember the website off the top of your head?
It's called FuturePresent. .org.uk.
Yeah, so I think that's a great way because I'm going to be listening to those before heading down on the 11th.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Sorry before I interrupted.
So who are these people? Who are being reenacted? Do they know that they're being reenacted?
What happened was that there are people, all the people that I interviewed, as I said, were people who kind of moved into the area at the time and stayed. I mean, that was quite a key thing, rather than people. Who sort of went away and came back again, and their experiences. That's during the first year when I was doing that, a film emerged of a festival that these very people put together in 1975. There were three of them actually, 73, 74, and 75. 75 was the biggest, called Megan Fair, and a good few thousand people attended. In 1975, and a small film crew from London came up and filmed it. So there's this hour film, this gorgeous 16mm film made of all these people kind of dancing in the field, expounding their their wisdom to camera, because they were obviously performing for the camera and talking about the age of Aquarius and how perfect it was to be amongst these standing stones and in this gorgeous wildness, even though they're sitting in the middle of a ploughed field, a mechanized industrialized landscape, but nonetheless there was all that kind of utopian talk there. So I've worked with that a lot, and I've reworked some of those images with friends, because obviously of the same kind of age, so that looks right. I've mixed some of the voices of people looking back who I spoke to at the just a year ago. I mixed their voices with their images of themselves nearly 40 years ago. So I've done a lot of playing around with that film and worked with that, used that film as a kind of point of reference.
And it's an interesting idea as well. You mentioned you've spoken to the people who have ended up staying in those areas. I suppose it would have been very difficult, but would possibly being able to track down the people who maybe went and then left again, would that give a completely different
I think it would, I was very much interested in sort of what happened over time as well. And the way people bedded down and, formed their roots in an area and how that happens.
The idea of transcendence, obviously, without going into nonsense, it's essentially, it's overlapping time time frames, different eons moving into one another.
Exactly.
This is obviously very, very, very tight time frame within the scale of things. How were you looking at the other overlapping cultures of that area over time, or is that just making a hash of it, making too much?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, but indeed, I kind of already had enough to deal with. I think that's
plenty, yeah.
But that's certainly, you know, where I'll go next.
Yeah, it's fascinating. A couple of poets were having a bit of a ding-dong conversation, Ian Gregson and Gillian Clark, about her use of the word dŵr, which means water, in some of her poetry, which was meant to represent the eons and the attachment of the Welsh language geographically.
Right.
And then the counter-argument, of course, is that language just moves wherever the people are. Mm. If people happen to stay on it in a geography, and that's where the language is.
Exactly.
That's a quite a long-winded way of asking the question. How much of the language did you look at, and how much of the shifting ideologies behind the incomers, did they take on the language? Did they...
Or was it something that perhaps, to what extent did some people perhaps not even think about it?
I think that's, as I said, that was the sort of generational thing that took a generation or two to work in that way. Because a lot of incomers, I mean, by their own admission, you know, didn't really engage with the language. But then, of course, their children went to Welsh-speaking schools, and pretty much all are kind of fluent Welsh speakers. So in terms of the next generation, and the next generation again, there's kind of... So the integration goes on or shifts, you know.
I like your translation of transcending as well, Trosgynny. I quite like that.
Well, I can thank Fionn Jones for that.
Oh, well done, Fionn.
Well done, Fionn. Thank you.
Fionn Jones of Talibont?
Yes, indeed.
She's lived around the corner from me.
And her project on sheep.
Yeah, yes.
That beautiful project,
she
yes.
She had an article, if anybody interested, in Planet looking at...
She did, yeah.
Yeah, looking at the all sorts of aspects of her PhD and agricultural life. Anyway.
Yep.
Back to the point. What happened with the car?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the
what
car.
Happened with the car? Well, there was a story. There was a great story that came out, and it just I couldn't get it out of my mind. That from a couple of people I interviewed, that back in the 70s, they'd go to a local pub, this in Crimich in particular, and that they would come out of the pub sort of having drunk a few, and in the car park they'd find their car had been overturned by the locals. In a playful way. I think they could be turned back and driven off home again. So you know, doors weren't and windows weren't kicked in or anything, but as an act of protest, I mean, that's why I couldn't get it out of my mind, because whenever you see riots that have taken place anywhere across the world on the news, you're probably going to see pictures of cars. Upturned cars or burnt cars. They're so symbolic of that.
Yeah, it's very visual personal possession, aren't they?
Exactly. It's that personal possession. They literally remove any sense of mobility.
And you do need a car around Crimich, unless you live in right in the middle of the town itself.
Yeah. So I just couldn't help. I just wanted to reenact this, and I was thinking about how to do it. And I ended up doing it at the Fire in the Mountain Festival. I wanted to turn the thing around, this sort of act of protest, into something, into sort of more almost a celebratory festive activity.
Yeah. So did you get a lot of people together to bounce it up?
No, well, I got this garage to deliver an old Volvo. And they delivered it into the yard. Good choice, yeah. Nice, heavy.
I learned to drive on a Volvo.
They're good cars.
Yeah.
Heavy cars.
Yeah. Well, those were the 340, not the big, big estate. Yeah.
I think if you'd chosen a lighter car, to make things easier.
So I kind of set it up, and then I just asked around a few blokes, and they were, well, where is it? Well, hold on, I've got to film it first. You know, just wait, hold you.
How many did it take?
And in fact,
Fire on the Mountain,
two of us turned it back again for the garage to take it away. But in the film that I've got, there are nine guys, big burly blokes who come along, and there's a real sense of euphoria, you know, throw their arms in the air, hey, when they've done it.
They would have been like that, though, when they those chaps would have done well, it originally.
Well, exactly,
definitely.
Yeah.
I reckon the chaps in Crimmich earlier on, they would have taken fewer than nine to do that.
Yes. One, probably.
Yeah. One international rugby player. Maybe they were doing, you know, if these chaps had been drinking, maybe they were road safety in mind. They can't hide their car, so they just put it on the
Well, right, I mean, that was another thing that came out of these listening to these stories was just about road safety. Reminded me of this, that, you know, everyone's cars were knackered. You know, bald tires. There was one story where this guy was turning around the corner and the wheel just fell off, and So everyone took all the back. They got to know the landscape extremely well, taking all the back roads to avoid the police.
Just to go back, and again, it's stuck in my head now. The car.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've made a joke about it now, and then you've reenacted it in a in a different context entirely, like in the idea at the festival.
Yeah.
But I suppose in essence, it is a demonstration of a particular culture, a particular group. It is a moment of clash, even though it is not perhaps not violent. It's a moment.
It's indeed
against each other. So, were there any other instances like that in your investigations in these oral histories, or those tensions? Did that come across at all?
Well, there were, which I'd have liked to have reenacted. I mean, there were tensions with. That I've, again, kind of subtle tensions with farmers, for instance, lending or helping out with a load of what they called hippies who wanted to kind of cut corn in a particular way, or sow corn and grow corn in a particular kind of old fashioned way, and so a lot of suspicion from farmers there, which is a difficult kind of thing to sort of orchestrate, I think, and kind of reenact. But there were interesting moments like that, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think for the car turning, that sort of contained that that sort of idea symbolically.
There's the symbolism is boiling away, perfectly happy on the surface of this exhibition.
Mm.
Did you find anything troubled you in any form, though? That's maybe an undercurrent of racism. I might as well call it out. Anything that was maybe a little bit unsavoury from that, because it's been relatively light-hearted, this discussion, but there's quite some aggression there can be sometimes and nastier elements. Did you find any of that?
I didn't, or maybe it was people didn't really speak about that. I mean, a few did, but most of that kind of tension came from people's backgrounds in the cities in particular. Where they felt unwelcome, felt that the kind of lifestyle that they wanted to lead wasn't welcomed, and that they had a feeling that cities were very kind of tense. A lot of people talked about that, actually, that they were living in this sort of heavy duty urban place. And
is that perhaps, I might be making a leap too far here, but you mentioned about the idea of this RK film you found of a camera crew coming from London to film, and perhaps then people might have left these cities and then perhaps being seen as curios themselves from the places from which they may have come in the first place. That wasn't a question.
It was a very good point.
Good point. Yeah. Well, this is true, actually. I think that's the... We kind of identify ourselves by our other. And it's interesting kind of listening to hippies saying, well, we didn't call ourselves hippies. The hippies were the trendy ones that came from the cities. And of course, the ones from the cities saw the people living in the countryside trying to do the back to the land thing as the hippies. Everyone was kind of, displacing their identity.
There's a, if you jump over the Preseli southwards towards the valleys, there was a strong movement of sort of essentially anti-culture, where that you were a citizen of the world. How many of these people did you talk to that simply weren't aware that they were entering another sphere, that they were all citizens of the world, and that the paltry nature of individual cultures was insignificant?
I think there were quite a few, and again, by their own admission, because I think all of them, I think, were very critical of themselves at the time. But also, as they point out quite rightly, you know, they're very young at the time. When, you know, 18, 19, they got in the back of a friend's van in Bristol or wherever, because they were going to a party and ended up staying. And incredibly young and naive. And so all of that kind of sensitivity, I think starts to develop later. And I think that's the interesting thing about, for me as well, kind of talking to people who'd stayed, and that kind of growing awareness, and a really thorough awareness of you know, what they're living in, what's around them, but taking time, yeah.
Anything on? No.
No,
there we are. No, okay.
Run out of notes. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
It's not
great.
Far. Are you nervous?
I'm a little excited? Bit nervous. I'm both nervous and excited. There's a private view on the 15th of August.
Lovely.
At 7:30 in the evening.
And it opens on.
And it's called private. It's not very private though.
No.
The exhibition itself opens on August.
The exhibition itself opens on the 11th.
And we haven't. It runs until September.
The 12th. September the 12th. Yeah. So it's on for a month. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Great. No. I'm looking forward to that now. So thank you very much for coming in, Ruben. Lloyd, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Dav.
Well, as usual, you know you've clicked on the right link when you're listening to the Planet Art Podcast. Yet again, a fascinating insight into the life of an artist and his or her work. Just as a quick note here, we will also, on the 11th, be going down with our cameras to capture some of the essence of what Ruben's been talking about here. So please make sure to log in at some point to the Planet website. You'll be able to see the video of that. Thank you very much for listening. You've been here at the Planet Podcast, looking at art in Wales. And thank you once again for your time. All the best.